Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the longest running web design podcast where we look at user experience design, conversion optimization, and working in the web. On this week's show, we discuss the WP Engine versus WordPress showdown, why the discovery phase needs a rebrand, and how AI can do almost as good a site review as you or I in a fraction of the time. My name is Marcus Lillington, and of course, joining me is Paul Boag. Hello, Paul.
Hello. How are you doing, Marcus?
I'm all right. It's the end of the week. It's nearly the end of the... It's nearly pub o'clock. It's been a
school's nearly over.
Yeah, it's been a week of firefighting, which is rubbish. You know, things breaking, and you know, like major things breaking, and then but none of them have been our fault. But for all the time when you don't know what the issue is, and people are getting stressed, it's like really stressy. But it's all been issues with hosting companies. I wasn't going to talk about hosting at all, but I'm going to have a quick moan on that. It seems that hosting has gone from being, unless you're paying 10 grand a year, it's rubbish.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Oh.
It's just gone, the price of it's just gone through the roof. And, you know, managed hosting has obviously become a thing. It's been a thing for many years, but it's become affordable in the last couple of years, but now it seems that the affordable managed hosting is not what one hoped it would be. Anyway, a minor moan.
Well, I don't deal with hosting very much other than my own website, and that seems to just tick along. Of course, we're coming to hosting where we talk about WP Engine.
Of course, yeah.
Yes, we'll be talking about that in a minute. But before we get to that, I owe you an apology because I was bad-mouthing you. Did you know that?
I'm not surprised.
All the time. You've become just so immune to it.
Go on then. Why were you bad-mouthing me, Paul?
I was bad-mouthing you to the Agency Academy.
Oh, because I never turn up to the call. It's a shit time for me, Paul, and it just is.
I was bad-mouthing you because you turned around and said that you weren't coming to this last Wednesday, because we have, for those that don't know, the Agency Academy is a group coaching thing that I run, where we have a load of different agency owners and freelancers who meet up every week, and we have a good moan and talk about different issues and that kind of stuff. So this last session, Marcus wrote, "Oh, I'm really snowed under with work, and I'm not particularly interested in this topic."
Which was
the truth. Which was the truth. And on the session, I was going, you know, Marcus, he should care about this topic. It's vitally important. You know, it's the future of the web, all of this kind of stuff. And you thought it was a completely different topic than it was.
Yeah.
We were discussing AI.
But when I looked, probably the day before, finance and some other acronym had come up. And I was like, really not interested in that, and top of the list, top of the votes at that point. So it was like, well, that's that.
Yeah, it shifted. It shifted at that, because what we do is that people can vote as to what we're going to talk about on each show. Call.
Yeah,
and we it shifted to be about AI, and so I was like, why is Marcus not interested in AI? It really should be. This is a really important thing. And, you know,
I am interested in AI, just not as obsessed as you are, Paul.
Oh, I am. Yes, absolutely obsessed. But in my defense, I do think it is an incredibly important subject. And I think it is as fundamental a shift as when smartphones came along, or even potentially... I can't quite make up my mind about this. I think it's a little bit too early to tell, but potentially as profound a change as the arrival of the web.
Yeah, it's either going to be that. I think smartphones gave people the internet in their pocket, which was great.
Yeah,
but this is different. I think AI is different. It's more fundamental than that.
Yeah, it is more fundamental than that. And I think for the first time in my career, I was thinking about this when I was on the call. I think I actually said it at one point.
Time to retire.
And it's really stuck with me. Wait, I say that to my wife every day. Can I retire today? Yeah. And she says no.
No,
you can't. All right then. But no, actually, I was reading a really interesting study on this that said that if you retire and you stop working completely, your average lifespan from that point is 8 years. So in a way, you're better off not retiring, but just, you know, ticking along at a lower level, which is what I'd intended to do anyway. So that's going off on tangent.
I'm going to, and this is Marcus logic I'm applying here, and there's no science behind this at all, other than I have met, it is a real thing that people retire and then lose their will to live, almost. I mean, that's a real thing. That's not Marcus science. No. And I've met, you know, there's a guy around here who's like that. And it's like, he used to work, in the paper mill up the road and was, you know, big cheese up there or an important person.
Yeah, yeah.
And then suddenly it was like, well, what shall I do now? And that sort of loss is why I think that figure, now we're into my science, the figure you come up with is because people, they don't have a reason to live. That will not apply to me.
No, because you've got your music.
Well, yeah, yeah. And I just don't think I'm not that wired that way.
No, you're not. So, no, you're not. You are a super laid back. I think it could happen to me. I think I'm more like that. So I probably won't retire. I'll probably continue to piddle around with stuff, you know. I'll still play with technology and I'll still blog about it, and I might even still do coaching and things like that. Anyway, that's beside the point. We're not going to start talking about retirement. That's what the other podcast is for.
Yes,
that's the other podcast. Yeah. So, but the thing that it occurred to me is, I think for the first time in my career, which is fairly long now and predates the web, the primary limitation is not technology, right? But actually my imagination to use that technology, right? So with everything else, up to this point, you've always been butting up against the edge of what the technology can do, okay? Websites, mobiles, all of that kind of stuff. We were having to find workarounds to get it to be as powerful as we wanted it to be, or do the things that we were imagining in our heads. But with AI, the thing that I'm realizing is that it's not, everybody looks at it and goes, oh, it's a chatbot and you can kind of talk to it and it can help you write copy, right? And that's it. We get stuck at that point, when actually there is, it is limitless what it could be used for. You know, you could use it as a therapist if you wanted to. You could use it as a, as a musician, as a, a co-pilot. Yeah, all right, you pull your face at musician. I'm not saying it's going to replace a human, and none of these things I'm saying it's going to replace. I mean, a therapist will pull a face at what I just said as well. But what I'm saying is that it's got so much potential to go in so many different directions, and that is just constrained by our ability to think of it. So increasingly, and as I'm saying this on the Academy, I'm almost having to force myself with everything I'm doing at every step of the way, in my job, to go, could AI help me with this? Because otherwise you just tick along with the things you've already always done and the ways you've always worked and your procedural knowledge, and you end up becoming obsolete because you're not, other people are going, oh, I wonder if I could use AI to do this and doing these amazing things with it. So yeah, I mean, where I'm at the moment is I'm forcing myself to accommodate AI in everything and giving it a good run, because of course the first time you do it is more convoluted and harder to do. But then you discover, well, actually I'm doing this now faster than I was ever doing it before, or better, or whatever else. But only when you force yourself through that pain barrier of going, oh, perhaps I need to give this a go. Perhaps I need to, you know, see if AI can help in this area.
Yeah, I mean,
so that's what I've been doing.
I mean, editing this podcast is a really good example of that. I mean, I tried to do it, but it just got too difficult, and I was stopped by the fact that I can't. The tool we were using, Descript,
yeah,
wouldn't allow the separation of our audio. So basically, yeah. I couldn't edit it effectively, and also editing copy as audio just didn't work for me. Anyway,
and that's fine.
But maybe I should just try harder. I think is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
but it was really clunky.
Yeah, yeah. But I would agree with, in that particular case, the not being able to have two separate audio tracks, that's a killer.
Mm.
Because we talk over each other quite a lot.
We do.
And so you need be able to do that. I hadn't thought that because I'd only ever used Descript just for me when I record audio. So yeah, was a very far, but the editing of the text thing, then yeah, I kind of, you know, you could argue that you just need to get used to a different way of doing things.
Yeah.
But it's like, I mean, another great example for me now is I'm using this tool called Whisper Pro. I'll put a link in the show notes if I remember. And it basically replaces typing, right? So instead of typing now, I'm just dictating rambling crap, basically. And it then turns it into a proper blog post or a proper email or whatever else, using taking out my ums and ahs and all of the rest of it. And I'm having to force myself to use it because, you know, you're so used to typing. I've been typing for 30 years, although I have used drag and dictate back in the day and various other things. But, you know, I've gone from typing, 50 words a minute to 240 with this thing, you know? It's forcing through that pain point, if that makes sense.
It does, because I think I would struggle to think in the same way dictating as I would typing. There's much more time.
Yeah,
you know, I'd be like,
you're right.
I've got to say something. Oh, I've got to say something, even though you haven't.
But yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's kind of like,
no.
That would be, yeah. That's a great example of that would do my head in. But I'll try it.
It would do. It would do your head in. Yes, but you manage it in a conversation all the time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So it's not. It's just a psychological barrier, you know, rather than a technological barrier, and. There is one other tool I'm going to mention. It just as a little aside, because this has been a frigging lifesaver for me. It's a tool called FixKey. We will move on in a minute. It's a tool called FixKey. And it basically, it does very similar to what is going to be baked into iOS and what's it called? The Mac operating system. In fact, by the time this comes out, it might even be there, which is like it's, you know, you can kind of say, make this shorter, make this longer, make this, you know, proofread this, all that kind of stuff with any text you select anywhere in the system. But you can also, unlike the built-in one, you can create your own prompts, you know, make this dot, 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 right? Right. And so the one thing that I've done is I've created
make this brilliant.
I've done a make this a better sales email. Right. Because obviously I send out a lot of emails following up on stuff. And so I've put in things because I get so frustrated when people don't respond. Right. We're definitely going to do this. Yes, we're going to do this. And then they go completely quiet on you and you have to follow up. And, you know, either if things aren't busy, I end up sounding desperate. And also irritated, right?
Yeah. Neither of which is good, yeah, in a sales
neither
situation.
Neither of which is good. So I just write this ranty, you know, angry, irritated, frustrated email and then say, make this a better sales email. And it goes through and removes all my irritation. And I put that into the prompt, you know, make sure I don't sound irritable, make sure I don't sound desperate. And do you know what? It's such a stupid thing, but it really deals with that kind of flaw in my character of wanting to say, why aren't you replying to me, you know?
Yep.
Anyway, let's move on. Talking
yes,
of
what's next?
Things already possibly being out of date by the time this podcast comes out. at the moment, as I'm recording this, we're in the middle of a big controversy about WP Engine and WordPress. Do you know about this? Have you heard about this?
We have been writing to our clients to assure them that all is fine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we host quite a few sites on WP Engine. Fortunately for us, we don't rely on automated updates. We do it all manually. So from our perspective, I was able to say to all our clients, that you may have seen this in the news, but it's fine. So yeah, very much front of mind for us. And obviously I'm saying that quite confidently now, but you're always like a little bit, what's next?
What might happen next?
But
So just to summarize, in case anybody hasn't heard of this, if I understand it correctly, because I've not been directly affected by this, but so correct me if I'm wrong, but basically there's been a big falling out between the founder of WordPress and WP Engine, where essentially as I understand it, WordPress are asking WP Engine to pay money for some arbitrary reason that I can't remember. For the first time ever, and WP Engine are pushing back and WordPress are getting all artsy. So what it means is that basically WordPress.org has banned WP Engine from accessing its resources, including plugins and themes. And so, like you say, it's not updating plugins and stuff like that. So it's screwed WP Engine's, which is a hosting company. Any site on there has been affected by this. And it seems to all come down to an attempt from WordPress to extract money from WP Engine, but I might be being biased. That's, and I don't know a huge amount of it, so who knows if I'm right.
I can't remember the guy's name, the WordPress guy.
Matt something. Yeah, I can't remember either. Well, I met him once, but that was a long time
my
ago.
My take on this is it's somebody shouting that you owe me 100 things to ensure that they get one thing.
Yeah.
Or a massive publicity stunt, not really sure.
Yeah.
But it's just, guy's an arsehole, basically.
Yeah. And so many people are getting caught up in this, it's innocent people are getting caught up in this as well.
Yeah.
And so many sites. And for, a platform that what consists of something like a third of the web is built on WordPress, it's incredibly irresponsible. But the reason that I wanted to bring it up on the show, because it might all have blown over by the time this goes out. And so I was umming and ahhing about whether to even mention it. But it does raise a really interesting thing that I'm a little bit obsessed about, which is the danger of building your business, in this case, let's say WP Engine, on top of another person's platform.
Does it happen a lot, though? An awful lot.
I know it does. It does. And it is it always worries me, right? And I'm a little bit kind of, well, what do you expect about it, right? Yes, but there is,
most businesses rely on other services, really important ones, that if they failed, you'd be in a right, your business might fail.
Yeah, and I find that hugely risky. I wouldn't build my business to the degree that my business would fail if somebody else just decides to change the rules.
Well, let me try and think of a good example, and this probably isn't a good example, but if I had a haulage business and the government decided to not put...
Government's different.
But let's say the roads were run by a private company and that company went bust and I couldn't run my lorries anymore. That would be an example.
Yes, it would be an example. But see, I would be very, very cautious about building a business. So let's give you some real examples, right, of where I've seen this happen and I've gone, okay, I've got sympathy for you, but on the other hand, you can kind of, it is a risk that you should have planned for from the outset. Tweetbot, right? Tweetbot was, one of the most popular Twitter clients, right?
Yep.
Then Twitter decided to change the rules and the API didn't, work the way it used to, and Tweetbot was screwed,
yep.
Right? And that's awful. Twitter's behavior was terrible. they took advantage of the people that had built their platform, but companies do that. Mm. That's what they do, you know? Another example, people who sell products through Amazon, right? And then they get all huffy when Amazon have been looking at the data and see the product that they're selling is selling really well. So they do their own version, right? And then just wipe out that other person's business. Apple do this all the time. Mm. They see good third-party products, they replicate them, right?
Well, I mean, really big companies will buy the entire company.
Yeah. So Apple, for example, have just produced their own password app, wiping off 1Password and various other, password providers. So there is an inherent danger when you build your, and I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, I'm just saying you've got to be aware that there's an inherent danger if your product or service is so reliant on another platform that if that platform fails, then it goes away. Now, where this really hits the road, because most of us are not in this situation, but where this really hits the road is with, like, if you go, well, I don't need a website because I can have a Facebook page or I can have this, or I don't need my own newsletter because I've got social media platforms, right? Mm-hmm. And then the platforms change their algorithm and suddenly you dive. So there is something very valuable in a business of building on open source, open platforms, which aren't going to disappear in the same way, which is why I'm always like, my website and my email list are my best, you know, the core of my business, because nobody can take those away. Nobody can change the rules around those, right? Mm. So that was my thinking. But I do it. I'm not saying it's inherently wrong to do that, but there is just an inherent risk with it. That's all.
There is. And one more thought on that. I would say with WP Engine, I mean, even if this did pull them down, I really hope it doesn't, because it would be a travesty if that did happen. They saw an opportunity to probably make a lot of money off the back of a very popular platform, which they've done. So even if it's all stopped today, it would be like, well, we've done all right. And it would never have happened without seeing that opportunity. Yeah, yeah. So sometimes it's like, well, you just ride the wave as long as you can.
Yeah. So. And it ultimately comes down to your attitude towards risk, right? Yeah, I'm an incredibly risk-averse person. And I think that's showing in the way that I'm talking now. Mm. You know, well, the other people have more of the attitude you've just said, and, you know, fine, good on them, you know, make the most of it while the sun shines.
Exactly.
But yeah, I just thought that was an interesting angle about it, because I don't think everybody goes into that with their eyes open, right? It's fine if you go into it with your eyes open, but, you know, some people don't, and then they moan later, and it's like, well, it's kind of going to happen, you know, a business, if they can screw you over, they will do, because they've got shareholders. Not that it applies in the WordPress.org scenario, because they're not a for-profit company, which makes all of this 10 times stranger.
Yeah,
but anyway.
The guy works for a for-profit company, which is...
I know, it's just
It's all about... And none of us had even heard of that company until now.
So anyway, right, I want to talk about an app. And obviously, because of my obsession with AI, it's an AI app at the moment.
Okay.
This is called Wevo Pulse, right? Now, this is a bit witchcraft to me, and I don't like it. I wish it didn't exist, and I wish it wasn't as good as it was. But I feel obliged to point it out anyway. So it's an AI tool that, as they describe it, they make it sound really, I think they're trying to say, I'm trying to avoid saying this is going to take your job away. So basically they call it an AI tool that provides real-time feedback and analysis on websites, prototypes and messaging. Basically it does a UX review of anything you point it at, right? So it will give you insights in a few minutes. So what it's done is it's taken over 1 million user research participants to produce kind of an algorithm that predicts what how people will respond to a website, a mobile app, a prototype, whatever you want to give it, really. It'll create personas of the people it thinks this will appeal to. It will then generate a list of, you know, suggestions about how to improve it, what's working and what's not. It will give you a rating. And really annoyingly, it does a damn good job at it as well. I ran it through one of my landing pages to get its feedback on it. And it nailed it. And I'm not just saying that because it gave my landing page a very good rating.
Here we go.
But no, it gave me some really good insights into how to improve it, and I was pretty impressed with it. I mean, the thing is you can't rely on any of these tools to do that consistently, and so you end up needing to be knowledgeable to know whether it's done a good job or not this time round, which somewhat undermines the point of it. If you're put it like this, right? When I mentioned this in the academy again, there was a big response of like, oh, this would be a really good thing to just send out to prospective clients to as a, you know, hey, look, we've been looking at your site and this is, you know, here's some feedback on it where we don't have to spend a lot of work doing that. And so it could be a bit of a sales tool. Or in-house, if you want to, say, convince your management that things need to change, then you run it through this, you get a nice little report, and you can send that off to managers and create a bit of, you know, interest in it. I'd encourage you just to go and give it a go. Obviously, the link will be in the show notes. So either in your podcast browser or just go to Boag World and look up episode 7. And you know, give it a go. You've got a 7-day free trial. It's a little bit pricey, $79 per month for 5 reviews, which seems a little bit higher than I would like it. But yeah, I thought it was an interesting app. It's worth checking out if for no other reason to run it on your own website and see what it says, you know?
I can't be bothered, or I'm too busy. I'm far too busy. But what I would to do is go to a site I've never been before and do a review of the homepage and then run that through the app and see how it compares with what my review did. I mean, it probably would be like, oh shit.
Yeah, it is a little bit oh shit. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, it doesn't, it depends on what your expectations are going in, right? It certainly exceeded my expectations, but it's not going to, you know, it's not maybe going to blow your mind. But I really, if one thing I do like out of it, I'm running so long, we need to move on. One thing I do like about it is that I kind of might copy its formatting and how it's kind of structured it, you know, because that was quite nice, you know, there's things you can pick up. It's like anything, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anything AI churns out, you always want to tweak and fiddle with. And that's, you know, fair enough. Anyway, let's move on.
What's next? Oh, I know what's next.
Yes.
Paul's super acronym.
Yes. you sneered at my super acronym. Was it in the last show?
I can't remember
when it was. Yes. You sneered at it. So I thought, no, I'm going to double down on this and I'm going to talk about it.
Shall I go make a cup of tea?
Just shut up. So I've basically what this comes down to is a lot of discovery phases. So discovery phases are great, right? We need to do them. They're an important part of the process, but they're not particularly compelling to senior management, right? Because it kind of throws up a load of questions in senior management's mind about why are we wasting time doing this, right? And that they can argue, it might be that your organization has got business analysts, right? And business analysts do this kind of shit. They review a thing and, you know, why do we need you to do it as well? Or marketers, you know, marketers do market research. Why do we need you to do it as well? So there's all this kind of pushback. And also, it can come across as oh, we just really want to spend some time thinking about this. Yeah, please let me do that. Well, that's going to cost me time and money. Just get on with it. Do the job. So it felt like it needed a bit of rebranding and repositioning. Now, so I've been thinking about that and how to position that and how to kind of find a place for this that makes sense in the head of senior management. So I came up with this idea of the Strategic User-Driven Project Assessment, which has got the acronym SUPA, S-U-P-A, which Marcus doesn't like. And that's fair enough. I accept that it's cheesy. But that's the kind of bullshit senior management like, right? Acronyms go down well. With some people, absolutely. But those who don't, you just can call it a user-driven project assessment, right? There you go. And the idea of it is that it's focused just on assessing a project from a user perspective, okay, and a user experience perspective. And that then differentiates it from what a business analyst does and from what a marketer does. Because a marketer is looking for, is there a market for this? Not how great is the experience of it. That's two different things, right? And so it's a way of UX teams being able to adopt a more strategic approach to validating a product idea and getting in earlier in the product cycle, okay? So normally they're brought in too late, okay? Where everything's already set in stone. So by introducing this idea of a user-driven project assessment, then it gives a justification for bringing them in earlier. And so what this will do, the benefits to the business of this, is that it helps optimize where resources are placed, right? So it prevents wasted time and money by ensuring that resources are invested in projects that truly matter to users. All of this is what a discovery phase does anyway. I'm just rewording it to be more appealing to senior stakeholders. It gives the project a greater chance of success because it's going to increase the likelihood of adoption from users and that they want to adopt it and want to use it. And it's a risk mitigation tool, right? So it will evaluate user acceptance risks up front, help gauge whether there's going to be user adoption and prevent investment in products or projects that users won't embrace. So that's how you position it from a business point of view. Resource optimization, increased chance of success, risk mitigation. And so it's answering questions like, does this project serve a priority audience to us? Does it address critical user needs? What's the likelihood of user adoption? What UX risks could impact the project's success? How does it compare to existing solutions that users are already doing, right? What changes does it require in what users are already doing? So it's almost like a UX health check for projects, really. And discovery phases are always a difficult one as well in terms of, well, how much time do you give to a discovery phase? And so, I'm basically proposing, well, when you do a SUP assessment, then you should assign 10% of your budget, right? So, the bigger the project, the more time you spend validating the risk associated with it. Now, I pulled the 10% out of my ass, to be honest. That just felt like about the right figure. But it's turning it into a process, do you know what I mean? And formalizing it. And if it's formalized, then yes, you're supposed to put 10% onto that, then people go, oh, yes, we're supposed to do that. And they all nod along and agree, because people are like that. And it basically exists to ensure that your project not only meets business goals, but also resonates with users. So what are the activities that go into this? Well, it's all the same stuff that you do in a discovery phase: UX benchmarking, user interviews, usability testing, stakeholder workshops, heuristic evaluations, journey mapping, user surveying, accessibility audits, all of that. So it differs from market research because it is looking at the potential for user adoption and the quality of user experience, not just ensuring that there is a market for the product. It complements what business analysts do because it understands it from a user need and behavior and adoption lens rather than a business lens. It all boils down to a deliverable of some kind of presentation or some kind of report. And I think it, from our point of view, it just empowers UX professionals a little bit more and, you know, puts UX earlier in the project that is thought about at the conceptual stage, not just the build stage. So, yeah, that's my thinking. I think, Marcus, it's really just the acronym that you've got a problem with, isn't it?
Probably. I wrote quite a few little notes and I summarized it by saying, I think what I'm really hearing here is this is about getting UX round the table earlier.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing. It's kind of like when you're doing the feasibility of a project, when you're doing a business plan or a business case, it's ensuring that UX is considered. And sometimes that's really important, sometimes it's less important. If the project that the UX team is going to, their next project is to, I don't know, to develop a website to support the updated product, then chances are if the user aspect of that is lower than if it was you're creating, I don't know, a service as part of a hospital or something like that. So, but yeah, of course, it's just basically trying to get senior management to consider, you know, fluffy designers like us to be taken more seriously. So there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. I don't think we're particularly good as an industry at presenting things in a way that resonates with management. And that's kind of my aim.
It's almost like actually the opposite. It's almost like the way our industry presents things to, you know, to management and executives actually rubs them up the wrong way. It's almost, it's like, oh, you know, we're telling them off. You need to be considering the user. Yeah. Stop thinking about money and all this kind of thing. You know?
Yeah.
And it's...
Yeah. It's an interesting one.
It's super.
It's super. See, it's catching on, Marcus. It's catching on. You'll find that a trending hashtag before long.
Will I?
You wait.
Okay.
Yeah.
I call all this user research.
And it is. It is user research. But if you're an executive, you don't care about the user that much.
Exactly. Yeah.
So why would you want to research in them? What you do care about is the likelihood of product adoption. You care about risk management, you care about spending your money wisely and that kind of stuff. So that's why you've got to frame it in those ways, really.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'll include a link. I wrote a whole article on this, which goes into it in a lot more detail that you can check out. And well, it was a newsletter, I think. And also I've created a landing page for me selling Super, basically. And that's worth looking at as well, because that's where I make these arguments in very kind of businessy terms. So check that out. And I think it's, I'm going to guess at the URL now. This is a very dangerous thing to do, isn't it? Guess for URL. This is where really you need to be a lot more organized than I am.
It's very early morning. Early in the morning, Paul. We'll let you off.
It's like 7 o'clock here. So the URL, he says confidently... Oh, no, it's a really long URL. That's shit. Boag will, it'll be boag.world/007. I'll make sure it's that by the time this show goes out. And that'll take you to the show notes and there'll be links and shit in there.
Links and shit. That's what we need, Paul.
Right. Last thing to wrap up the show. Okay. I found an article called 16 UX Quotes You Need to Read as a UX Designer. So I thought this would be fun.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is I'm going to read out these quotes and you have to go, do I agree or do I disagree with these quotes?
You know what I'm going to say to every single one, don't you?
What's that? It depends.
It depends.
But go on, you need a You need to give a hard yes or no to it,
hard
right?
Hard yes or no.
So I'm not going to say the names of who said them because some of them were going to just pull apart, right? So that's a bit cruel. There'll be a link if you want to go and look all these up. Okay.
Go on then.
A problem well stated is a problem half solved. Agree or disagree?
I agree with that. I'd even say it's more than that.
Yes, I would agree as well. Right. We'll get on to the ones we disagree with. It'll come. A consistent experience is a better experience.
Of course.
Yeah, that's kind of... Yes, that's an easy one.
Yes.
Creativity is allowing yourself to make mistakes. Design is knowing which ones to keep. That sounds to me... It sounds like it's designed to sound very clever, but I think it's bollocks. You don't keep a mistake.
Good point. Yes, yes. I was missing the obvious logic there. Creativity is allowing yourself to make mistakes. Design is knowing they're all mistakes. There you go.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense. That one makes no sense whatsoever. There are three responses to a piece of design. Yes, no, and wow. Wow is the one we're aiming for.
Oh, that's 100% okay. Of course.
Wow. I don't think it...
What?
How often... I guess, perhaps I'm looking at it exclusively from a UX lens. You know, if you're talking about marketing design, maybe.
No, Paul, no. But, the reason why I have an example of this recently, because, you know, I can recognise design, and I'm not going to use the words wow and pop, but rich design, if you like, rather slightly unnecessary design. But sometimes in my job, I know that if we have a rich design like that, it's going to make my job easier. It's going to make us, the client's going to be like, ooh, about, and they're going to get a good feeling. But recently, Lee, I was pushing Lee on some initial design work that he was doing, saying, oh, I think we need something else. I think we need something richer here. I'll use that word. And he pushed back really strongly and said, doesn't fit with the brand. This is what the brand is. And I just said, you're the designer. I'm stepping back from this. You're absolutely right. And of course, the design that we came up with fits with the brand. It is great for purpose. Spot on, basically. So, no, I don't agree with that.
Yeah. And the example that sprung into my mind was signage in airports. That's design. Mm-hmm. You don't want that to wow you. You want that to be invisible. You want it to be so intuitive that you just go there. Want your users to fall in love with your design, fall in love with your users. That seemed fair enough to me.
Yeah, it's a little bit, yucky language, but yes. Understand your users. Yeah. We'll deal with, shall we?
Good design is more important to differentiate ourselves from our competitors. Good design is the most important way to differentiate ourselves from our competitors. No.
Yeah, no.
Don't agree with that.
No, based on, I won't repeat my previous rant.
It is a way of differentiating, but not the most important way, you know, anyway. If you think good design is expensive, you should look at the cost of bad design. Love that one.
Yeah.
Oh, you're pulling a face.
It depends, doesn't it? Depends, you know, it might be that the whatever your thing is, the design of it isn't that important. But I'm picking it apart. Yes, good one. Move on.
Yeah, I like that one. I like the sentiment behind it. You know, yes, there are always exceptions with these things, but I like the sentiment. I think it's a fairer sentiment. Like all forms of design, visual design is about problem solving, not about personal preferences and unsupported opinions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Easy. Because every person knows what he likes, every person thinks he's an expert on user interfaces.
Well, we've seen that, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. We have. A bit nitpicky, but I think that's beginning to change a little bit.
I think so too.
People, you know, are recognising, okay, perhaps I don't know as much as I think I do, but yeah.
Were you at the IWMW, I can't remember which university, Edinburgh maybe, when the Chancellor came out and did a big speech to kick it all off, and basically went into his early 90s or mid-90s critique of why websites aren't good. And it was all to do with, you know, make sure everything's above the fold. And it was, painful. So it is true, but I also agree that that's less the case these days.
Ease of use may be invisible, but its absence sure isn't. Again,
that's a bit like
that's the, very similar to the other one, isn't
it? Cost of bad design one, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But I agree with it. If I have 1,000 ideas and only one turns out to be good, I'm satisfied. Piss off! that ratio's horrendous.
Not good, is it? Well, it depends how creative you are. If you have an idea every 10 seconds, then maybe it's fine.
Yeah, I know what he's getting at. I'd be very literal over that one.
Yeah,
1,000 ideas.
I'm going to name this person. It's Alfred Nobel. So yeah, kind of fair enough if you're in that level of, like the best ideas. Of the year kind of thing, then if 1,000 ideas one is that good, well, okay, fair enough.
If I had a designer who only produced one good idea in every 1,000, I'd fire them. If you find an element in your interface requires instructions, then it needs to you need to redesign it.
Yeah,
it's a general rule of thumb. Yeah,
but then
there's always exceptions to everything.
Yeah,
but yes,
icons. That's the one always gets me. It's like just use a word, and then you're like, well, but what about people that don't understand English? And then we'll use different languages. At the moment, we've currently got an interface that we're designing that the kind of go button, if you like, is a search magnifying glass. And it's like that's fine. Kind of, you could argue that it wasn't, but it's kind of fine for a keyword search. So I'm going to type in a word and I'm going to hit that button with the magnifying glass. But we're using the same button now to kind of, we've added filters basically and other things that once you hit a filter, you then need to hit that button. And it's like, well, doesn't really.
No, it's not really the right icon, is it?
No, anyway, so it's a design issue. We've got some ideas on it, but yeah. So
yeah,
I can't remember what they said.
I like using both, if I'm honest. Yeah. Anyway, using an image and text, but yeah.
I agree.
Okay. Oh, you agree?
Yes.
Right. The ability to simplify means to eliminate the unnecessary so the necessary may speak.
Yeah.
Pretentious way of saying it, but yes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
the myth,
exactly. Yeah, but certainly one of the things I always do whenever I think I've finished a design is I go through and I look at every element on the page and say, can I remove this? Because if I can, I should, because then it lets the other stuff, it gives more attention to the other things that are on the page. Mm. Genius is the ability to reduce the complicated to the simple.
I think it's more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's more than that as well.
I mean, good design is the ability to reduce the complicated to the simple.
Ooh, I like that, Marcus. You need to be quoted on websites. Don't stare at a blank page too long. Be bold and make the first incisive stroke. The rest will come naturally. Get what he's getting at. Agree with the sentiment. Rest will come naturally. Not always. Yeah. Sometimes you make the first stroke and then stare at the second stroke and go, shit, I don't know what to do still. Uh-huh. But the principle is right.
It is. It's the old adage of when you write it on a paper and screw it up and throw it on the floor. Then you write on the next bit of paper and screw it up and throw it.
Yeah. Some people think design means how it looks, but of course, if you dig deeper, it's really how it works.
Yes.
That's a famous Steve Jobs quote. Okay, I thought that was quite interesting.
I enjoyed that, Paul.
Yeah, it's a fun little game, isn't it? Pick other people's quotes apart. People do it with me all the time. I say things and then they get quoted in these articles, and I think, oh, no, don't just quote that bit because,
I made it up.
I made it up, and it's got no context, and, now it's being quoted. Oh, dear. So I'm sure people have torn my stuff apart, I felt I was justified in tearing other people's comments apart.
Yeah.
Anyway, Marcus, what have you got joke-wise?
Right, this is from Prescott Perez-Fox, who is on the BOMAG World Slang channel.
Yeah.
What do British sea monsters eat?
Now, he's an American, if I remember correctly. So this better not be derogatory. Otherwise, he's in big trouble.
It's not.
Go ahead.
Fish and ships.
Oh, dear, that is terrible.
That is perfect for our show. Great job, Prescott. That's just wonderful. I love
it.
I love it.
That one. You have to say it. You have to say.
Yeah, yeah. It would. Yeah, it's going to get written in the show notes, and people are going to go, "What? That's a bit shit."
Anyway.
But yes, very good. Okay, that wraps up this show. If you want to get to the show notes, go to boag.world/007. I think that's everything for this time. And thank you very much for listening. And goodbye.
Goodbye.